All right, welcome to Making the Argument. Before we get started, I have a very important announcement. We have a brand new deal with GoodRanchers.com. That's right. If you go into Good Ranchers and you use promo code Nick and you sign up for one of their subscriptions, you're not only going to get $15 off, but do you remember the old deal where you got 2 pounds of ground beef with each order? Well, we just upped the game. That's right. You can choose top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon now. Every single order you get on that subscription is going to come with free top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon. You get to choose which one if you use promo code Nick. And again, $15 off on top of that. That's a savings of $480 in meat by signing up for one of those subscriptions. Not to mention the fact that if you are looking for a gift for someone that is impossible to shop for, you can go on to goodranchers.com and get one of their brand new gift boxes. Now, this is a limited time only offer. It's part of their overall Black Friday special. So go on to goodranchers.com to get more details. Sign up for promo code Nick in order to get that deal, and let's get on with the show. Hi, this is Nick Freitas, and welcome back to Making the Argument. We're going to go into part two today of our series on the culture wars or the culture conflicts that we're seeing right now. And when you look at our previous episode, and if you haven't listened to that or watched it, I recommend you go and do that. Because we're going to get in today on some of the responses to those issues. The first episode, we really laid out kind of what some of these things are. Today, we're going to spend a little bit more time on the responses to those arguments, but we're also going to look at how can you effectively engage in the culture in a way that is going to be meaningful to achieve the sort of change that you want to see. I can't tell you how many people right now that are so frustrated with politics, so frustrated with the way the direction that the country is going, and they feel like no matter what they do, it doesn't really have much effect. And the bottom line is that if you look at some of the things that a lot of people are doing, they're not wrong. It isn't having much of an effect. And that's because I think we're putting too much reliance on who gets elected president or who's controlling Congress. Those things are important, right? They're important. They deserve our time and our effort. But it's really not the only way. And I would even argue that in some ways, it's not the most effective way to engage with the culture in a meaningful way to bring about the sort of change that you want to see. All right, so let's do a real recap, a real quick recap of what we talked about last week. We talked about postmodernism, deconstructionism, Marxist philosophy, critical race theory. And one of the things that's common within all those, you know, components, if you look at postmodernism or deconstructionism, right, the whole idea is that there's no real such thing as absolute truth. There's just individual perspectives on truth. And the foundational problem with that philosophy is that the moment you say there's no such thing as absolute truth, you're making a self-defeating statement. And I've seen people go round and round on this conversation before where they're trying to come up with a way to demonstrate to somebody, well, then no, there must be truth. Let me make this real easy. The moment someone tells you that there's no such thing as objective truth, the question that you ask them is that a true statement? Right? Because how are they going to respond? If they say, yes, it's true that there's no objective truth, well, then they've just contradicted themselves, right? If they say, you know, no, it's what I just said is not true, well, then why are you listening to them? Or as one professor once said, is when somebody tells you there's no such thing as truth, they're asking you to not believe them, so don't, right? So again, don't feel the need to get into all these like complex debates about this. The moment someone is making that kind of claim, they've really defeated their own argument. And it's important when somebody does make that claim and you want to engage in conversation to open them up within their own presuppositions, right? So if there's no such thing as truth, well, again, that statement itself is self-defeating, but also it creates this real problem where we can't actually arrive at a good, thorough understanding of what is true versus what is not true so that we can, you know, decide how we're going to work together, how we're going to interact together, what's good policy versus what's bad policy. All right, so that's really important. And like I said before, when we get into things like Marxist theory where everything is about classes, right, one class dominating over another class, or we get into critical race theory where you've, again, got some of these postmodernist tendencies where racism is not proven based off of an action. Racism is now proven based off of how someone felt about what somebody else did or said. Well, again, I can't disprove your feelings, right? And I don't really have a desire to disprove your feelings, but it's not good enough to just say that because this made me feel a certain way, therefore an injustice has taken place, right? You have to be able to provide, you know, facts and evidence that we can all analyze in order to be able to arrive at that conclusion. And if you're not willing to do that, well, then this ends up becoming nothing more than a battle of feelings. You feel this way, I feel that way. And if you're a applying a postmodernist philosophy where, you know, neither one of us are right or wrong based off of how we feel, or we no longer have a process to objectively look at evidence in order to decide, you know, why something happened a certain way, or whether or not it's just a result of people making different decisions, or it's a result of genuine injustice. You know, if we can't get to that, well then it really creates a problem in society where we're no longer able to peacefully solve our problems. It just becomes a question of who's going to dominate over someone else, and people using the government as a mechanism to force other people to do what they want, right? So those are some of the underlying problems. And I would really encourage you when you're talking to somebody that has bought into some of these ideas, and there's a huge social and cultural push to buy into these ideas, right? If you buy into critical race theory, if you buy in to class theory and things like that, no one really accuses you of being a mean person or a bigoted person or an uncaring person, right? So there's social benefits, unfortunately, right now, to buying into these philosophies, even though they don't add up philosophically and the data doesn't really back them up as well. So it's important for you to understand how to effectively engage in this. And I really think asking questions is critical. One of the biggest things I tell parents is when your kids are starting to question certain things that you've raised them to believe, there's a certain point in your child's life where when they're really little, prescription works, right? Don't do that because mommy or daddy said so. When they get older, they're looking for more explanations, and they have a right to look for those explanations. And sitting down with them and explaining things and getting their feedback and asking them, you know, why they believe what their college professor told them and opening them up within their own presuppositions, that is going to get you much farther into having a civil dialogue and getting back to this idea that the way we solve problems is not by cramming everybody into, you know, positions of class or race or sex and then deciding that if you fit into one of these categories, then you're supposed to believe these things. It's more about, once again, the flowering of individual thought and encouraging individual thought, because that's what truly treats people as being beautifully and wonderfully created with a unique purpose, to having an inherent worth that is not associated to something like class or race. It's their very humanity that gives them that worth. And if we can argue from that perspective, that's really the crux of what we believe, that you as a human, you as an individual, have inherent worth, and we want to be able to create a society where you can go as far as God-given talent and hard work will take you. And as a society, we want to remove those barriers that are truly unjust. But by the same token, we also understand that people make different choices, and those choices yield different results. And some of your circumstances are beyond your control, but a lot of other aspects of the decisions you make are fully within your control. And so the beauty of a free society is about understanding that not everything is going to be perfectly equal with respect to circumstances. But we should have a legal system which views people equally. You shouldn't get preferential treatment before the law based off of your race, based off of your sex, based off of your economic circumstances. That's the sort of thing that we can all agree on. But unfortunately, as we move more and more into this idea within the culture that any sort of inequity in society is an automatic result of injustice, that's a problem, right? If people take very different career paths, there's going to be different results from that. And that doesn't mean that one person was oppressed and another person was an oppressor. Right? Or it doesn't necessarily mean that. And it's important for us to be able to, again, break down the argument down to its foundational level, fundamental level. What do we think about human beings and humanity in general? Do you have an inherent worth as an individual? Do you have the right to be able to go forward and plan your own path in life? And should you be required to accept the consequences for your decisions? And should you be protected when somebody else infringes on your rights, right? These are all the sort of the questions that we really need to be able to get to the bottom of in order to have civil discourse and decide where we're going to go. And that's part of the whole point of this podcast, right, is getting back to that idea of, no, we want there to be equality before the law. We want people to be able to use their talents, use their property, use their time in a way that they see fit. But a critical component of individual liberty is personal responsibility. And one of the most damaging aspects of a lot of the things that I see within Marxist theory, within critical race theory, is this idea that they're taking away individual agency by chalking everything up to privilege or circumstance. We are adopting this language where you no longer have control over your life unless you have control over every aspect of your life. Well, look, nobody has control over every aspect of their life. There's always going to be circumstances which you find yourself in that you didn't anticipate or that you might not have chosen. But you still have the choice with respect to what you do in those circumstances. And so from a societal standpoint, clearly we don't want the government interjecting and harming people or holding people down as a result of their, again, their race, their sex, their economic status. We don't want that. But we also don't want to use the government as, you know, some sort of agent that is going to, quote, level the playing field. Because ultimately what ends up happening is that now in order to fight an injustice or a perceived injustice, you're now perpetrating injustice on somebody else that didn't do anything wrong in a quest to level the playing field, right? So equality before the law, yes. Private property rights, absolutely. Individual liberty, every time, right? The moment you give the government the power to try to correct every inequity or every difference of outcome, you're going to inevitably infringe on people's individual liberties. And that's an important question that we have to ask people when they respond to us with this idea that the government has to play a larger role in not simply providing equality before the law, but enforcing or imposing equality of outcomes without understanding how different individuals came to those outcomes. Right, so that's kind of a once over the world, response to again that postmodernism, deconstructionism, Marxist theory, critical race theory. The next thing I want to talk about is, you know, how do we engage? So obviously we know this is going on. We know a lot of these undertones. Sometimes it's overt, sometimes it's more subtle, but we see it, kids being taught this in public schools. Academia is obviously pushing this narrative in a lot of ways, but we also see it within the media, we see it within TV, we see it within movies, the entertainment, the art you look at, the music you listen to. And a lot of conservatives feel as if it's just overwhelming, right? Because even if you have someone that's willing to step up and engage in that environment, well, big tech will shut you down or the government will come after you. And so it feels like it's a completely uneven, you know, playing field. And that leads to a lot of frustration. And again, I think a lot of that frustration is justified. But the other thing that we have to look at is how did we get here, right? It's not as if people pushing this kind of leftist ideology within society and within culture at large. It's not like they did this yesterday. This has been a very coordinated effort over decades. They made a play for the schools. They made a play for the arts and entertainment. And largely conservatives stayed out of the fight or surrendered on a lot of these grounds. And yes, now we find ourselves in a position where it's very hard to break into these environments as a result of that. And so people ask, well, you know, what can I possibly do to fight back against this? And here's the first thing I want to tell you about that. If you have convinced yourself that the only way that you're going to be able to change this is with a new president or a new Congress or new rules or regulation, there's two things I want you to understand. One, that's a way to fight against it, and it's a good way, it's not a bad way, but it's not the best way. And again, going back to this argument, right? The reason why a lot of this ideology made its way into institutions was not because some law was passed requiring it. It was because people got into positions of influence, moved up the ranks within organizations, and over time changed the culture of the organization. Right? And so we have to be willing to invest in a long-term strategy. There's no simple answer to this. And I realize for a lot of people that just want to be able to work hard, raise their family, live their life, go on the occasional vacation within a free society, we feel that what we believe is just, and it's ultimately what America is built upon. And so we shouldn't have to be having these fights, right? Didn't we already prove that Marxist philosophy doesn't work? You know, hasn't centuries of study in the scientific method and logic and reason, you know, hasn't that already won the day? And the thing that I would just go back and say is that it is perfectly fine to be frustrated that we feel like we have to constantly re-argue for things that seem so obvious to us. The problem is that the moment you give up that fight, the moment you assume that you've just won, you are opening it up for counter theories and counter ideas to come in. One of the things I take issue with in the Declaration of Independence is when it says we hold these truths to be self-evident. That's great, and I agree with that. I think those truths are self-evident to me. That all men are created equal, that you're endowed to, certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I find those incredibly self-evident. But because at some point we stopped arguing for them, not just in politics, but across the full spectrum of cultural institutions, we should not be shocked or surprised now that a different narrative, a different ideology, and a different philosophy is now on the rise. And it's important to understand, as much as we don't like to hear this, this is not a battle that you win. It's a battle that you continually fight. And the more you fight it, and the better you fight it, the more you can live in the sort of society that you want. But there's never a point this side of heaven where you can just say, okay, we're done. We've won the argument. We've won the elections. We're done. Truth demands an advocate, and it's something that we have to continually fight for. And one of the most important ways that you can effectively fight for it is by focusing on the sphere of influence that you have. Right? If you're putting all your energy into the next presidential election, okay. I'm not saying you shouldn't work on presidential elections or for candidates that you support. You definitely should. But if that's what you're counting on to save everything, I would say you're playing the short game. You're not playing the long game. And so let's talk about how you can be effective within your sphere of influence. And the other thing to point out here is that a lot of people don't find campaigning fun, right? They don't find door knocking or making phone calls or standing at the polls for 8 hours on election day to be something that's, just a barrel of laughs, right? It's something that you do because it's a sacrifice that you make in order to try to help your country be better, right? And sacrifice is required. I'm not getting around that. Sacrifice is required. But there's a lot of things that you can do that you actually enjoy, that you have God-given talents for, that you can also use in order to help create and help foster the sort of society that you want. And if you're doing things that you naturally like, you're far more likely to do it consistently and over time, and you're far more likely to have an impact on people because, I know that when I enjoy what I'm doing, I'm a lot more convincing in what I'm doing than if I'm just begrudgingly doing something because I feel like I have to do it. And so that's the first point here. What are your talents? What are the things that you enjoy? And how can you take the things that you enjoy and use them to make an impact that affects the culture? So for instance, if you're an entrepreneur, And you love to invent and you love to create businesses. You love the idea of going through the process of taking something from a concept or an idea and then building it out to a product or a service that makes people's lives better. Maybe it profits you as you build a business. It allows you to employ people. That whole process is a wonderful story. And I want to give you an example of how some entrepreneurs did this in a very real and relevant way. There's a program where I live called E Squared. And the best way to describe E Squared is it's a little bit like Shark Tank. If you've ever seen that show where you have, three or four really prominent business owners, and what they do is they on this television show, people come and they pitch their ideas. So you generally have someone that's new to business, they have a new idea that they want to throw out there, they're looking for advice, they're looking for investment, and now they get the benefit of talking to people that have been in the same place they were and made it. They were a success. And you see this dialogue that goes back and forth. And look, not everybody wins, right? Not everybody gets the investment. But everybody ends up walking away more knowledgeable and with a better understanding of how business works and how they can be successful and how they can get products and services to the people that need and want them. So we had a bunch of entrepreneurs in our area and they came together and they talked to the school system, and the school system at first was reluctant. They didn't like the idea of taking time away from class time in order to do this Shark Tank idea. They didn't like the idea that only one team would win. But these business owners said, look, let's just give it a shot. We're gonna lay out the process for what we're gonna do. And no, not everybody's gonna win. Every team that competes is gonna get knowledge and they're gonna be better off for the knowledge. But one team that wins is gonna get a very significant prize. Like each student's gonna get, you know, a scholarship that they can take to college or they can take to some other, you know, educational or economic, you know, they can apply it toward that sort of opportunity. And what they did is they started off with, they got their teams together. And they took them through the process of, you know, developing a concept, identifying a need within the marketplace, identifying a need that was underserved or maybe wasn't being served at all. And they took them through the process of what they would need to do to come up with a pitch, what they would need to do to come up with a business plan. How would you go through the patent process? How would you go through, you know, critical analysis of your product and the marketing for your product in order to be successful? And some of the ideas that have come from these students are incredible. Some of them are fairly simple, like coming up with a smartphone adapter that will take any sort of plug-in. Another idea was one where it was a triage band that if you have a mass casualty incident, your first responders can go around and put this triage band, which automatically feeds vital signs into a central hub that they can monitor of everyone within the environment. So when you have limited resources, you can focus those resources to the people that need them the most. So these really cool inventions and ideas. But one of the things I found fascinating about it was a testimonial that a student provided. And at the end of the E squared, and his team happened to win. He was one of the people that got the scholarship. And he came back and he said, you know, I don't plan on being an entrepreneur. I don't plan on starting a business. I want to go into a different field where I'm inevitably going to be working for somebody else. He goes, but one of the greatest values that he received from this E squared program was he never understood the complexity and the difficulty and all the challenges on running a business. Now, I want you to think about that. Even though the student is not necessarily going to take everything he learned within that E squared program to start their own business or to invent something new, that is a much more informed voter now. When some politician tries to convince that student that business owners are mean, greedy, you know, horrible people that, you know, exploit their employees, that's a student that now has a real practical experience that they got within their education that taught them that, no, there's another way to look at this. And this is not as easy as it's sometimes made out to be. And the amount of time and work and effort that an entrepreneur or a business owner goes through is really intense. And it's something to be admired, not something to be demonized. Right? Those entrepreneurs, those business, you know, former business executives, former business owners, former leaders within industry that decided that they were going to set up this program in a small rural county in Virginia, have had an enormous impact on a huge number of students in ways that impact was not being made before. And that's the sort of thing that I want us to start thinking about, right? It is, how can we be effective in our sphere of influence? How can we take our experiences and use them to teach valuable lessons, practical skills, but also good philosophy to the next generation? A lot of what I'm going to be talking about here in this segment is about how do we influence the next generation, because that is the strategic view that we need to see. So that's one example of people that came together. And, you know, again, they didn't set up a political course. They didn't set up a philosophy and, you know, an understanding of the Constitution. They focused on something that they liked doing, that they enjoyed doing, that they knew would be beneficial to students, and they found a way to make it relevant and effective to them in a way that not only the students benefited from, but they personally enjoyed. And that, it's just a perfect, it's a beautiful example of how people can have an incredible effect within their sphere of influence that didn't currently exist. All right, what's another way that you can do this? You know, COVID has provided this unique opportunity with respect to education, because we have so many schools that are either partially opened or completely shut down. And now we have a lot of students that are struggling because online learning is just not conducive to every student, right? It can be an effective component of education, but for very few students can you just completely disengage with online learning and not have that person-to-person contact. And we have students falling behind. So what are ways that you as a person with experience or a person with education, what is a way that you can now step in and fill this void that has been created by a pandemic that has led a lot of your public schools to essentially close down and not be able to provide a quality education for students? Well, let me just talk about a couple of the opportunities. One is the whole homeschool community and homeschool co-ops. I'm willing to bet that if you go online right now and you just Google homeschool co-ops in my area, or in my state, you'll have a bunch of things pop up where there are co-ops. There's groups of parents, groups of teachers that have come together, and they have different systems. There was a homeschool co-op that I taught at. You met once a week. And so I taught government economics and Christian apologetics. And I would come up with a lesson plan. And the first semester, the beginning of the semester, I would talk with the parents. I would talk with the students. I would discuss what they were going to be learning. And a lot of their education obviously took place on their own. It was only one day a week. But there was a way that I could then contribute and pass on knowledge that I had as serving as a member of the Virginia General Assembly. And when I taught government, I didn't just teach it from the textbook. I got to provide them unique experiences that I possessed as a result of being able to working within the General Assembly. I'm willing to bet that if you think about the different experiences that you've had throughout your life, how beneficial could that be to a potential homeschool co-op? You're also starting to see these micro schools set up where you have teachers, a lot of them public school teachers, that are so frustrated that they have to try to teach everything online. And so they've tried to come up with these additional things where they call micro pods, where in order to maintain social distancing or maintain a health conscious environment with respect to COVID, they've provided learning environments where you have fewer people in a smaller environment where they're able to provide additional tutoring. And that's the other thing to remember here is that it's not that you have to come up with an entire lesson plan, but if you know that you have kids within your community that are currently going through an educational experience that isn't working for them, and they could really benefit with some tutoring to supplement what they're learning within school, that is a huge opportunity for you to be able to come in, help that student with a need that they have, right? You are meeting a need, but in that same idea, you have the ability to not just teach within the textbook because you're a tutor. You're not bound by the laws of the state with respect to the tutoring that you provide. You have the ability to provide the practical examples, the personal experiences that are going to make that lesson come alive for them and be relevant to them in a way that they may not get through their online learning or through the textbook. So that's another opportunity where it doesn't require a lot of time. Maybe it's only one day a week that you tutor. But you have an ability to be able to share those experiences and share that good philosophy and apply that to the text in a way that they otherwise wouldn't receive. And I'm willing to bet all of you have a teacher at some point in your life, a teacher, a tutor, a coach, some sort of mentor that really helped you understand that you go back to and you remember fondly because they helped you become a better version of yourself. And that is a huge way to influence the younger generation. So look for those opportunities. I briefly mentioned coaching, and that's one I want to go into as well, because the other thing that we're starting to see is a lot of school sports programs are shut down right now. This is a great opportunity for civic organizations to be able to sponsor youth sports. Right? This is not something that has to be a function of our public school system. This is something that can be a function of civic organizations. It can be a function of the church. I really wish the church would get more into youth sports and youth activities. Because one of the things that, debates that I've been in with people before, and sometimes you have parents that get upset because they feel that too much money is invested in sports programs in schools and not enough in academic or enough in the arts. And I'm not here to argue whether or not that's true or not true. I think you can make a good argument either way. But one of the things I think it's important to understand from the sports perspective is that if you are looking for an environment, and really, more and more, one of the few environments within academia where conservative values are taught, look to your sports programs. I mean, if they're being taught and coached correctly. But in a lot of our sports programs, I got a good friend who's a coach. He loves doing it, not simply because he wants to make his the football team he coaches better, but because he sees it as an opportunity to be able to help kids, especially in his case, a lot of young men or young women that are growing up in environments where they might not have a positive parental role model in the home. A lot of these kids are growing up, they don't have dads in the home. And so he sees this as an opportunity to be a positive male role model and to be able to influence them, not just in, you know, how to catch a football or you know, how to run faster or jump higher or perform better on the field, but think about the core tenets when you look at an athletic, when you look at a sport and some of the ideas and the philosophies that go into it. The idea that it's not just all about you, it's about the team. That there are objective things that work and don't work, right? If you drop the pass, it doesn't matter how you feel about the drop. You don't get to identify as having caught the pass, right? You either catch it or you don't. There's objective standards for what constitutes success, and everybody has an opportunity to learn the skills and the rules in order to be able to effectively compete. But the only way they're going to succeed is not just through the competition with the other team. The other way that they succeed is through cooperation with everybody else on their team and recognizing that everybody has a unique and important role to play, and that if everyone is doing their job, not just one person that's showboating, not the person that's slacking, but if everybody's doing their job, the ability for the team to be successful, and as a result, each individual on the team to be successful, increases exponentially. The lessons behind that, the life lessons involved in that, are critical. And when you look at a person in a position of coaching, when you do have a competitive environment and you do have these sort of objective standards, and that coach goes beyond, again, just the fundamentals of the game and really goes into the idea of developing character within people. To understand, it is partially about you, but it's not entirely about you. You have a job to play. That job is critical not only for you, it's critical for the team in order to achieve success, right? The harder you work, the more successful you're going to be. If you love sports and you've never considered getting involved in youth coaching, I would highly encourage you to do so. You will be shocked at the level of influence that you can have, not only their ability to play the game, but at the way that they look at life and how they go through it and assuming responsibility for their actions and understanding that their actions affect other people and they can either do it for good or for ill. Right? These are critical lessons that coaches have the unique ability to be able to educate and provide to students. And so I'd really encourage that. Another thing I want to talk about is when we look at how, so that's been a lot on the education, right? The tutoring, the homeschooling, being able to get involved within coaching, all these are ways. The other things I would have mentioned, things like getting involved with youth organizations like Cub Scouts or youth group at your church or Girl Scouts, you know, Heritage Girls. These are all ways that you can have an influence and you can share your experiences in a way that'll be beneficial. And really impact the culture, not just now, not just in the media, but in the future, right? So that's kind of the educational category. Another category I want to move toward is this idea of how do we address needs within society? One of the biggest questions I get when I say that, well, I don't think the government should be doing this, or I don't think the government should be doing that. The common response is, well, if the government didn't do it, who would? And here's what I'm going to tell you all as conservatives. If we don't start becoming the answer to that question, then we have no right to be shocked or could be or confused or frustrated when the government fills that role. Right? There's a role for the individual. There's a role for the family. There's a role for the church. There's a role for civic organizations. And if you look at the way that America used to solve problems, people within America used to solve problems, and Alexis de Tocqueville's book, Democracy in America, which was in the early 1800s when he came over from France and wanted to view the United States and how we operated, not just as a government, but as a society, as a community. One of the biggest things that he pointed out that he thought was unique about American society was that he said that in Europe, if there was a problem, people were generally, you know, wondering when was the government going to come in and fix this problem. And what it does is it created this kind of apathy within society where people didn't see that they had the power within themselves to either work as an individual or as part of a group to solve local problems. And then they were frustrated because the government solution never really addressed the problem the way that they wanted, or there was unintended consequences. And what fascinated him about American society was the emphasis not on government to solve problems, but on voluntary associations and voluntary groups coming together to address a problem. And if it was more of a permanent problem, then the civic organization might stay forever, right? If it was a temporary problem, they came together, fixed the problem, and then dissolved. They didn't go around looking for more, you know, to create more problems so that they could justify their existence as an organization. I feel like we've lost that to some degree in American society. And conservatives sometimes buy in to what I think is a leftist idea of the world when we put all of our emphasis on solving problems by putting our people in charge of the government, right? That's really not conservative philosophy, right? If we buy into that, we've kind of already lost the argument on a fundamental level. We need to get back and looking at it, like, how do we address these issues? When somebody loses their job, when somebody's house burns down, when somebody's having a hard time getting health care, when our small business that we love is, you know, dealing with difficulties that are no fault of their own, like with COVID, what are the ways that we can be the answer to that problem without automatically engaging the government? And so this is one area where I think one of the most justified critiques of the modern church in the West is that a lot of church groups have kind of given up on that biblical mandate, that biblical responsibility in order to meet people's needs, their spiritual needs, but also emotional needs, social needs, and material needs, right? If somebody shows up to your church and they've lost their job and they need assistance, does your church have a fund in order to help them, or do you just send them over to a government agency? Do you send them over to a government program? Because I will tell you right, if your church just sends them to a government program without trying to meet that need internally for a member of your congregation, I would say you're not fulfilling your biblical mandate. You're rendering to Caesar something that is your responsibility. And if you allow Caesar, if you allow the government to take over that responsibility, don't expect it to be done effectively, don't expect it to be done efficiently, and expect the government to constantly justify the increase of its own power and authority to interfere in your life. Because if you're going to put them in charge of solving the problem, well, they're going to demand more money and authority to be able to do so. But our churches provide a great, you know, churches, synagogues, it provides a great nucleus within our communities for people to see that is a genuine community, not just a place you go on Sunday or Saturday in order to get, you know, spiritual training and education, which is good, but really see themselves as part of a community that provides that structure and that infrastructure to be able to meet some of these needs, whether it's education, whether it's daycare, whether it's, you know, when they've fallen on hard times and they need assistance. We have the ability within that church structure in order to be able to do something. It is a perfect mechanism for being able to meet these needs. Let me give you an example. You know, you have a single mother who's doing her best to raise a couple of kids, and she's working hard. She's having a hard time making ends meet, and so she's getting some sort of public assistance. As she does better within her job, and as she moves up the ranks, and as she becomes more productive and starts to make more money, the government starts to cut off those benefits. And if she doesn't feel that there's anywhere else that she can turn to, her only recourse is to essentially do worse in her job or to quit her job so she can get her benefits back and then go back into the same occupation. We put her in a cycle. And look, we can argue all day long about how should we restructure welfare programs in order to make sure that they don't do that. We've been fighting about restructuring welfare programs for decades, and we'll continue to fight it for decades. But there's always going to be incentive for some people to create a welfare system that doesn't allow people to truly escape it. It doesn't provide a hand up. It essentially just puts them in this perpetual cycle where they feel like they can never rise above their circumstances, no matter how hard they work. Their kids grow up in an environment where, from their perspective, the government it's just there to provide things. And now we end up perpetuating a really, really destructive mindset, not because that person had that mindset, but because it was essentially beaten into them by bad policy. And there's no excuse for civic organizations, for neighbors, for churches to not step into that environment. If that mother is about to lose her child care benefits from the government because she's about to get a new promotion that she's been fighting for, why doesn't the church step into that environment? We have the structure, we have the people, we have the volunteers. How wonderful would it be if that mother knew she could depend on her church to meet that material need? How wonderful would it be if those children could be in an environment that was going to nurture them and tell them that, again, they're beautifully and wonderfully created in the image of God, and that they have a purpose to fulfill in this life that is uniquely their own. How wonderful would it be if we were able to step into that environment and meet a need that was going to benefit not only her, not only the children, but society in general? And you can look at it the same way across the board when it comes to helping people. And again, this goes back to the idea of don't find the most, you know, don't find the thing that you hate to do and then force yourself to do it because, you know, you want to do your part. Now, there's going to be times where you have to do things you don't like in order, again, times you have to sacrifice to make an impact. But find the things that you're good at, that you enjoy. You know, how wonderful would it be that if somebody falls on economic circumstances or maybe you have, you know, that family where the husband or the wife is deployed overseas and the family really needs help with something, if they could go to their church and say, look, I'm really struggling, I need this, and all of a sudden the church is providing those services that they need for that family. You know, the house burnt down, whatever it is. But looking at our community and creating an infrastructure to where when somebody is in need, their first instinct is not to go to the government. Their first instinct is to go to the family, to go to the church, to go to these civic organizations, because there's that personal connection. And I'll give one example of a personal example. I mean, I know what it's like to not be able to make ends meet. When I was a private in the military, I obviously wasn't making a lot of money. My wife and I had another couple staying with us because they were, you know, they were in the process of switching bases. They needed to save money. We wanted to give them a place to stay. But the electrical bill just ended up being, you know, too much, and we got our power turned off. You know, we had friends and family that stepped in, you know, members of our church community that stepped in to help us out. And what I found that was so fascinating about that was not just how wonderful it was, obviously, to have a material need met when we needed it, but the psychological effect of that. This wasn't some distant government agency that was helping us in our time of need, my wife and myself and this other family who had a small child at the time. This was us knowing the people that were helping us and knowing that we're not entitled to what they're doing for us. They're doing it for us because they love us and they care about us. And that didn't engender a sense of entitlement in us, it engendered a sense of gratitude. And on top of that gratitude, it engendered a sense of wanting to pay that back to somebody else when we had an opportunity. And one of the greatest joys that you know, I've had later on in life is to be in a position where I see someone that is, you know, someone that reminds me of, you know, reminds my wife and I of us 20 years ago and being able to help them when they needed it. And if you really want a system where we can help our neighbor and we can help people, a big part of it is not creating a sense of entitlement in society, but a sense of gratitude. And that that sense of gratitude does not come from another government program. It only comes when people help people. And these are all ways that you can have an immediate impact and a long-term impact, that you can actually see the results of your actions in a way that is meaningful to others and as a result, meaningful to you. So what I want to encourage you to do going forward is, you know, yes, look for those ways to engage within the realm of politics. Join your local, you know, Republican committee or whatever political party. Join that local committee and make it better. You know, do the phone calls, the door knocking, you know, the graphic design, whatever it is that you think that you can lend to that argument. Fight in that political sphere. But remember that if we're really talking about a long-term strategy, we have to engage with the culture. Politics is downstream from culture. And there are so many different things you can do, from setting up a program like E-Squared and using that business experience that you had to be able to, you know, really provide an educational opportunity that these kids would never otherwise get. Tutoring. You using the skills you have, the talents you have, the education you have, to be able to provide examples as you educate that reinforce those good philosophies. Coaching, being able to speak into somebody's life, not only to make them better on the field, but to improve that character, to make them better off the field as well. Right? And then again, working through your church, working through civic organizations to be able to meet people's needs, whether it's that daycare, whether it's, you know, education, whether it's providing assistance to somebody that can't fix their roof, whether it's about providing financial assistance to somebody that's fallen on hard times, lost their jobs, and needs someone to come in and help. and to do so in a way that, again, doesn't create a sense of entitlement, doesn't create a sense of shame associated with the government coming in and playing the role of the family or the church, but creates, genuinely fosters true community within groups of individuals because you're there for each other spiritually, emotionally, and meeting those material needs as well. If we can get focused on that, if we can stop making everything about the next election cycle, and we can start focusing on the individual spheres of influence we have, the organizations that we're a part of, the needs that we know exist in our community that we don't got to wait around for anybody to tell us. If we're sitting there saying, why doesn't a politician do something? We're asking the wrong question, and we're betraying what our real core philosophy is. We're not the sort of people that wait around for permission to help somebody in need, to make our communities better. And it's time that we live up to the legacy that we were provided by being born in this country, to go back to that idea that Alexis de Tocqueville recognized and was so impressed by, the ability of free people to work together in voluntary cooperation, to not only make their lives better, but to make life better for everyone. And if we are willing to rise up to that call at this point in time when it is the most needed, we will have an impact that will stick with people for generations. And that will have far more influence later on in how they view society, how they view their role, how they view themselves, and how they view their government. But if we're not willing to do it, then we only have ourselves to blame. I want to thank you again for joining us on Making the Argument. I hope you found this useful, helpful. If you're looking for more ideas, please, you know, as you listen to this podcast, give us a like, give us a share, write a review, because this will help the podcast be able to get out to a much wider audience. Share this with your friends. And again, if you do have questions for us, if you have different ideas that you want us to go over and talk about, you know, how do we make an argument for it? How do we make an impact? Leave that within the comments. Leave that within your review so that we can actually create episodes around what you want to see, what's on your mind. That's what this is about. This is supposed to be instructive. This is supposed to be helpful, so that we can create a real impact. This is not just an academic discussion. This is about creating an environment where we're not only able to articulate what we believe, we're able to live it out in a way that has the most impact. Once again, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Once again, thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the show, again, one of the best ways you can do it is by heading over to goodranchers.com with promo code Nick. You're going to get $15 off. You sign up for one of those subscriptions, and you're going to get up to $480 of free meat with that subscription. You get to pick top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, bacon. It is all up to you. Plus, if you're looking for gifts to get for the people that are impossible to shop for, goodranchers.com also has gift boxes. You need to act quick. This is part of their overall Black Friday special. So head on over to goodranchers.com, use promo code Nick, and once again, thank you for listening.